Hello, friends. She's beside herself with glee. Do you know why? Because this is a very important and very special episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter, and I'm here with my good friend and giggly business partner.
It me, Alice Slater. I will say, when I laughed then, I fully thought that we would just start again.
No, we're just plowing on. We're plowing through. The reason we're in high spirits is because Alice's book, Death of a Bookseller, is out in the world.
It's out in the world. It's happened.
A real book. Aww. It is on the shelves. It is out in the hands, in the grubby little mitts. And we are going to chat about it today because it would literally be illegal for us to not chat about this book.
Imagine.
It would be outrageous. How are you feeling?
I'm buzzing. I feel all right. I feel like people keep asking me, like, how are you feeling? You know, like, obviously it's a really nerve-wracking thing. But I'm simultaneously moving house. And I feel like the best cure for stress is to find something even more stressful.
Yeah.
You know, like, find something else to worry about.
This is a wild moment in the life of Alice Slater. When I write your biography, we'll have to spend quite a lot of time on this.
Really digging through the DMs, the texts. Yeah.
This moment. So we are obviously going to discuss Death of a Bookseller by you, Alice Slater. I know you love to nutshell. Would you like to nutshell your own book?
I can, because I've been having to do this a lot. So, Death of a Bookseller is about two booksellers, one of whom is, like, the best person you could work with, and the other is the worst. So, we have Laura, who is new to the shop. She's just, like, new gal about town. Everyone loves her. She dresses cute. She, like, is fun and gets along well with customers. She just loves her job. She's really good at it. And then there's Roach. Roach has been in the shop for a very long time, is very indifferent to bookselling, and mostly dislikes women like Laura. But the main thing about Roach is that she's really obsessed with true crime. So as Roach gets to know these new booksellers, she discovers that Laura maybe has some darkness in her past that she gets kind of obsessed with. So it's a book about obsession and true crime and bookselling.
Yes, it is. Would you be able to take us back in the past? What is the origin story of this book? Describe its inception, its creation. Tell me everything.
Okay, so obviously, as listeners of this podcast will know, I was a bookseller for Waterstones for like 6 years. I had so many highs and lows. You know, I worked in so many different shops. So I gained like loads of experience in bookselling. And it was like 2016-ish. And I was working in the Ilford branch, actually, specifically. And I just started thinking about, like, the way that bookshops are often perceived in fiction as, you know, like, very quaint and beautiful places, very calm.
Utopian spaces as well.
Exactly. But they're always indies. They're very rarely, like, chain stores. And, you know, the Ilford branch has been knocking around for a while. It has its quirks and its charms. But I started kind of, like, thinking about that I'd quite like to set a book in a space like that. And then Roach also came to me. Roach as a person came to me before Roach as a true crime fan. But yeah, I was imagining, like, what's like the antithesis of the kind of ideal perky bookseller. So I created this little freak. But then I had this character and I had this setting, but I didn't really have a plot. That came like much later, actually, like maybe 2019. I started working on this kind of true crime narrative. Mainly because, like, we had been, like, really deep in our true crime era. Mm. Like, I was watching all the shows, I was listening to all the podcasts, reading all the books. And obviously that always came with this, like, constant debate about whether or not true crime is ethical. Like, who owns the stories that we're buying, selling, telling? Who are the victims that are being left out of the narrative? Like, you know, like, is it ever an ethically or morally, like, correct okay thing to do? Yeah, like a sound choice. And so that's really where the kind of whole book came from. I didn't really have a thesis in mind as I was writing it. I hadn't made my mind up already. I was like exploring it through these two like polar opposite, like quite extreme characters. And then I decided, you know, let's make it weird. Let's bring a snail in.
Take it extremely dark. It's kind of the accumulation of, like, quite a lot of time. Like, it wasn't like you sat down one day and were like, I'm going to write Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater. It's like a thing that's been, like, bubbling away in your little noggin.
Yeah, that's why I've always found it quite difficult to answer that question. Obviously, now I've answered it a few times, so I've got my story straight. But the truth is that, like, some bits of it came from, like, diary entries from when I first was a bookseller. Like, I really looked back at, like, my experiences when I was much younger. Some stuff came from a short story that I'd started writing that didn't really, like, Laura and Eli, another bookseller in the shop, their kind of plot was originally just a short story. The characters had different names, but it was still kind of, it was set in Leytonstone rather than Walthamstow, whatever. So that kind of, there's lots of little bits from different places. I love cannibalism, and I love to cannibalize my own work. And when I realized that I'd given Roach a voice, but I hadn't given Laura a voice, and I felt that actually sometimes Roach's voice was too light because I was trying to write a character that hates bookselling, but I don't hate bookselling. Mm. And I kept finding my love for bookshops and bookselling kept appearing in Roach's sections. So I kind of lifted them all out, plonked them into Laura, and that's kind of how that character was born.
So you've already addressed like three different things that I was going to ask you questions about.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's fine, because there's more that I want to ask about all of the different things. So I'm going to ask a different question now and then return to the other stuff further down the line.
I'm learning. I'm a terrible interview subject. I'm just fucking like a...
You just love the chat.
I'm just like a fire hose, just spraying all of the good shit.
So obviously because I know you and have known you for a very long time, I know your kind of writing history, and that is this the first novel you've ever finished?
Technically, no.
So your postgraduate, no, there is another one. Yeah, lurking.
So
somewhere.
When I was a teenager, I wrote a 100,000-word novel.
That's outrageous.
I know, and it's completely gone. It's lost entirely. I remember I had it on a floppy disk. I always called it the Freedom Project, as its like working title, because I couldn't decide what to call it. And it was basically like a really naff ripoff of, I say naff, but I'm actually very fond of it. And I'm very fond of Teenage Me for doing it. But it was kind of like a ripoff of The Beach, but set in a kind of country house where these like teenagers, sort of 17, 18 year olds, decide to try and set up a commune, and it all goes tits up. It was really fun.
Good. I think
maybe I'll rewrite
it. I think you could definitely revisit that.
Like how Terry Pratchett revisited Carpet People. His novella Carpet People was something that he wrote as a 17-year-old and then he came back to in his like 40s.
I love this.
I'm gonna Pratchett.
I think you should definitely Pratchett that shit. But obviously between writing your 100,000-word magnum opus and writing Death of a Bookseller, you did a lot of other writing in between.
Yeah.
What do you think it was about this project that meant that you not only finished it but sold it, and sold it for, you know,
she was all right.
Real okay. Money to a real publisher, yeah. Shall we say. Yeah, what was the ingredient that you think made you finish this?
So I've actually been thinking about this a lot, because partly it is the book itself that I didn't stop having fun with it. I enjoyed it. I didn't get stuck. But also I feel like that would be, it's not entirely true. I feel like it's a pinch of that. But also I'd only written 40K. And it took me a long time to squeeze 40K out of my sad little brain. I think I spent maybe 2 years on the first 20K a year. 2 years writing, yeah, about 20K. COVID, I wrote another 10K. And then I got my agent, because I got agented in a kind of unusual way, which I can go into, but I don't want to divert my tired brain. So that really helped. That helped finish it. But the reason why I managed to stick with the project for so long, I feel like partly it was leaving bookselling. Because I loved bookselling. I loved it so much. But I had developed plantar fasciitis, so my feet were in constant pain. I was exhausted all the time. I had progressed to managerial work, which was like really knackering. And so I just was always very tired, which I put into Laura in the book. Laura is a writer, and she talks about never always having the three ingredients you need to write, which is time and inspiration. And what was the third one? Energy. And that was 100% me. So partly it was moving into a job that actually facilitated creating the work. Partly it was getting an agent when I was still only halfway through the writing of it. And then also, honestly, I think it was just having the right equipment. For years, I was writing on knackered laptops. It took ages to start up, and I finally bought a computer that works, and that really helped.
And I think there is so much value in talking, you know, because obviously this is like a drum I beat like endlessly about like how we think about and talk about writing as a pursuit, that it's often in quite kind of abstract terms and, you know, about like suffering writers and whatever. But I think it's so useful to people to talk about the reality of like the practical stuff that stands between you and writing. And maybe it is having a shit laptop. Maybe it's doing shift work. So you don't have like a very clear sense of like, when, what is my free time? When is my free time? So yeah, I think that's very useful and realistic.
And yeah, and I think also the one thing, the advice I would give to myself, if I had to jump back in time to when I was still years away from leaving bookselling, the advice I'd give to myself is to find any other way. Like, the shit laptops aren't working, so maybe write it on your phone.
Mm.
I've written so much of this novel on my notes app when I was just, like, on my commute or exhausted or just sitting at a computer, because my day job is now copywriting, so I'm writing all day as well. And, yeah, I feel like I don't actually think the expensive equipment is necessary, but I think that figuring out what it is about your equipment that's not working is... You know?
Yeah, the expensive equipment may not be necessary, but that doesn't mean that the barrier you're experiencing isn't a real one.
Mm-hmm.
Those two things can exist at the same time. So something I'm interested in is writing these two characters that are in opposition to each other and to a certain extent are like opposites, but they don't operate on like an identically kind of divided binary. Like, they both have kind of, you know, darkness and some light in Roach's case. Don't know how much, but
she loves a snail. She's a woman who loves a snail.
That's the her saving grace, is a woman who loves a snail. So tell me about the process of developing them as characters.
So Roach, as I said, came to me first, and I think actually one of the challenges with Roach, once I'd removed all of the more like the sunny stuff that was more Laura, I worried that the character was too dark. And actually I was still in the writing process. I think I was like halfway through my first draft when I read Boy Parts and I was like, fuck it. Like if Eliza Clark can write, Irina Sturges, then maybe my Roach will be okay. Mm. Like maybe she won't be universally hated, but that is why I gave her Bleep. I needed
a humanizing
something, yeah. Just also something, although it's still a snail, and I like snails, I think they're cute, it's a little bit weird, but otherwise all her other interests, like horror movies, like rock music, like they all still exist in quite a one-dimensional space. Yeah. And you know, we all contain multitudes, right? So I had to lighten her up somehow, and I decided to give her Bleep.
I think that was very wise of you. And so something I found interesting about the book, I will attempt to describe it, is that both sections are told in the first person, but Roach's is in the past tense and Laura's is in the present tense. And that is the case even though it's not like Roach's sections throughout the book contain like a huge amount of like foreboding or reflection. What was your decision-making process in that respect?
So, past tense, I guess, is my default anyway. First person, past tense is my preference. So, the book started with Roach, that's where we were. You know, that's what we did. I did actually have some moments of reflection, but I do think that if you're writing a book that contains a lot of retrospect in it, so like Richard Papin from The Secret History, for example, he talks a lot about, you know, you sense the distance yeah. between the narrator and the action. I actually didn't want that for Roach. I wanted her chapters to still have this real sense of immediacy. I decided to write Laura in the present tense for two reasons. Firstly, it just helps really differentiate the voice.
Yeah.
I don't know if you find this, if you ever experiment with past and present tense, but I find that I write very differently in each voice anyway.
Yeah.
So that just made an immediate personal differentiation, then also just for the reader, more literal. And then also it put a question mark over it. Like, ultimately, in terms of like the philosophy of the narration, if there a character is speaking in the past tense, then either they're a fucking ghost or they're alive at the end of the action. A character in present tense, however, is truly vulnerable. Anything could happen to them. And it just created that question mark regarding the title.
And also in the book, you know, we won't go too into details of what happens in the book because we're so close to the book coming out. But the things that Laura experiences are probably more exciting to write in the present tense as she is experiencing them, as like a emotional and visceral reaction to the weird shit that goes on for her that she doesn't necessarily understand.
Yeah, I think I'm glad that that's the way around I chose to do it. Although I do think that Roach is creepy crawling. She has a few close shaves, which I think could potentially have been as dynamic in present tense. But
something I found funny about that is that when you normally read or watch a character doing that and having a close shave, you don't want them to get caught. But with Roach, I was like, get that bitch.
Yeah, that is kind of one of my regrets, is I do wonder if it would have been more fun to have had a longer confrontation. Like, I ended up stuck in such a tight space. It took me ages to figure out how to maneuver the final confrontation between the two characters. Because I was like, I have to do that. I know as a reader, that's what I would want.
Yeah.
I want to see the shit blow up.
Next time. You've got loads more books in you. Don't worry about it.
I'm just going to rewrite this one again.
Pratchett it.
Deather of a bookseller.
Bookseller-er.
She's still...
More might, bookseller.
Or might not be dead.
Who knows? So how much would you say it changed over the editing process?
Oh my God, so much. So much. So my agent saw a very different book.
Zoe
Ross, my queen, currently on maternity leave. So the book that she saw only had Roach, and lots of stuff was different. So in my very first draft, Roach had a very bougie mother who was a true crime writer. So the original book, the two characters had a kind of maternal connection to true crime, but it felt a bit too neat, a bit too convenient. And so I stripped that out and ended up with a completely different plot.
I love this.
Yeah.
So, but
Murder Your Darlings.
What you sold to Hodda was the two perspectives.
Yeah. So okay. I think that, my memory's a bit fuzzy.
It was a weird time. We were deep in Rona. It was cold.
We'd all gone insane.
Yeah.
I think at that point I had added Laura in. Yes, I had. So the first version that my editor at Hodda saw was a different book. And then we edited the fucking shit out of it as well, because there were lots of puzzle pieces. I don't write in a linear way, so I often find myself with these like very beautifully crafted bits and then just a load of tangled junk to try and connect them. So yeah, we had to spend quite a lot of time like beating it to make it flow.
Yeah,
I hope you can't tell.
You cannot tell. You cannot tell. I really, you know, I'm not just saying that because I'm your good friend and business partner. I'm interested to know, I feel like, you know, it's quite obvious the ways that book selling has informed this book, but there is another part of your life that I am interested to hear you talk about, is your creative writing MA from the University of East Anglia. To what extent do you feel like stuff you learnt then has been relevant to your publishing a novel now, or is that so far in the past that you're like, I'm done, bitch?
So I always find the MA question is obviously quite loaded. I know you're not, that's not your angle.
I have no angle. Yeah. I did an MA that I hated. I have no opinion on MAs of any description.
So basically, I loved my MA. I loved Norwich. The friends that I made, I'm still friends with now. I absolutely loved it. The thing is, I also feel like I kind of have to acknowledge that when I did my MA, the fees were $5,000.
Mm.
I just lost my father, so I had some money. So I was able to just pay for them outright, no loans. So I always feel a bit like cautious when I talk about how beneficial it was, because it's something that I know is not accessible to everyone. That being said, for me, it was a dream. Spending a whole year just focusing on your craft, I learned so much. And as I said, like, one of the most valuable things is also the classmates, who, as I said, like, still friends with, just the most, I just feel so lucky. So I loved it and I don't regret it at all. It's just, it feels like such a complicated area for creative writing specifically. And I wonder if other arts based degrees experience the same kind of
anxiety and,
yeah, or just like anger and like I feel like, because you don't need a qualification to write, you don't need that piece of paper, but yeah, like spending so much time being so focused, having like being surrounded by classmates who have the same focus, having access to that incredible library, having access to the, you know, Norwich has an incredible lit scene, so the number of authors who came through, and then obviously the university itself sets up loads of industry like stuff. But then truthfully, I feel like everything that I learned about the industry at UEA, I learned way more from Twitter. So I feel like if doing an MA for the sake of imagining that you're going to make connections that are useful to you is probably the wrong vibe, you know, like you, that's not something that you should really worry about. You can find that elsewhere, but it's that luxury of time that was just second to none in terms of like building me as a writer, even though that was like, God, I was 24. That was such a long time ago now, over a decade ago.
It feels like the, you know, the Laura to the Roach of trying to write on a broken laptop while bookselling, you know, like when you just have loads of time, you only have one thing you need to do. Like that's the colleague you want to work with.
Yeah, absolutely. Although it's funny as well, because obviously I was only 24. I'd been fresh out of uni. I think I took a year out between my undergrad and my postgrad, and I definitely did not make the most of that time. Even though I had a fucking great time, but like I didn't read as many books. And I think now, like a whole year just to read and write, I think it would look very different.
Yeah.
But fuck it.
We never know this stuff. Well, you know, you can only look back and be like, ah, I should have done all of this. So something that as a lady on the internet, I'm kind of obsessed with is the idea of parasocial relationships.
Me too.
Let's talk about them. Because that's what I think, you know, is at the core of Death of a Bookseller, is, you know, true crime and parasocial relationships. The dynamic between Laura and Roach is that they do not really know each other at all, but Roach feels like she knows Laura. And I feel like that's a dynamic that I don't feel is like super explored in books as much as it could be, maybe, because I think it's such an interesting dynamic.
So the thing is that although when I was writing the book, I was thinking very much about parasocial relationships, it's something that I'm really interested in. In the end, though, I actually feel like I didn't end up writing a book about parasocial relationships, because actually Roach is very aware
that she doesn't know her.
That they're not friends.
Yeah.
Whereas I think one of the key, although Roach does think she understands Laura,
yeah,
one of the key things about a parasocial relationship is that one person genuinely believes there is a friendship of sorts there.
Yeah.
That there is a connection.
Whereas it's more like a spurned lover dynamic.
Yes.
Or like exactly. A kind of toxic relationship where like the bad boyfriend is like trying to win you over with like gifts and whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And also like Laura is very aware of Roach. And Laura, I think Laura makes her feelings very clear. And like some people find Laura's behavior towards Roach really mean. And Laura is a little bit mean. But also I think like her position is legitimate.
And she has completely good reason.
Yeah.
It's not just that she gets a bad vibe from her. It's like they are fundamentally incompatible for like one very specific core reason, which is that Roach is really, really into true crime and Laura is very, very prickly about true crime for very understandable reasons.
And when you dislike someone as well, like that is so personal.
Yeah.
Then Laura and kind of inevitably has such an ungenerous reading of Roach, which I think is inevitable because like the nature of that true crime connection is so personal and so dark. Like, she can't afford that generosity.
Yeah, and it kind of pollutes everything that she sees in Roach. But it's also not like it's a small part of Roach's life. It's like a very big part of Roach's life. What is your... I would like to return to something that we touched on earlier. What is your relationship to true crime?
So,
We had a Diet Coke before we started recording.
I hope they did that really quietly.
Yep.
Just a little burp from the author. What was the question? Oh, true crime. So when I started the book in earnest, so I always feel like I started in earnest in like 2019-ish, and I feel like that was at my peak true crime reading. 2017-18 is probably the peak. But I really, it went from something that I did devour on the regular. I listened to a lot of podcasts, I watched whatever was out on Netflix. I read whatever more literary book had come out. I kind of still was a bit snobby about it, but I did also end up reading a lot of trash in looking for the good stuff. And when I say trash, that's not me trying to be a genre snob. I just mean the kind of true crime books that, for example, like disrespectful about sex workers, that kind of thing. Yeah, do you know what I mean? Like real crap. Anyway, in the writing of this book, I had to do a lot of fucking research. I had to read a lot of true crime very quickly, and I had to watch a lot of shit very quickly. And I don't think I realized it when I was like in the bubble, but I think that it was doing me quite badly. I was incredibly anxious. We were living in a ground floor flat, and I quite regularly would be incredibly scared, even going to the bathroom on my own, walking past the dark kitchen window, standing in front of my dark bathroom window, I would feel like I was being hunted for sport. Like my heart would be absolutely racing. And in retrospect, I felt very vulnerable because I was reading these fucking murder stories all the time. So since finishing the book, I actually haven't really gone near true crime since. I don't know if I've like divorced myself from the genre entirely or if eventually my morbid little mind will win and I will return to it. But for now, yeah, I feel like I went from someone who, obviously on the podcast, we've done many episodes where we talked about true crime books. It's something that I think something would have to be really, really compelling, interesting. Yeah. For me to want to read it now.
It's interesting. I find, the internal question for me is like, is consuming true crime bad for my mental health, or do I listen to true crime when I'm already feeling miserable? You know, I find that is a thing that I have not figured out, because I haven't listened to true crime podcasts for quite a long time, and that has come hand in hand with like just feeling very happy. And it's like, did I stop listening to them because I was feeling happy, or am I feeling happy because I stopped listening to them?
You know what though, I just realized that when I say true crime, I also explicitly am thinking of murder.
Yeah.
Whereas I did actually listen to Sweet Bobby.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah.
And I quite, you know, like the scammy ones, yeah. Like ones about people.
Or conspiracy theory stuff.
Telling wild lies.
Yeah.
I'm still doing all that. I'm still on my bullshit in that regard. It's just the old murder.
Yeah.
Got too much.
Well, also with kind of conspiracy hoax, catfishy stuff, you can have the people involved participating in a way that, like, with murders, you inevitably can't.
Yes.
So it feels different.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's not to say if, like, I'll Be Gone in the Dark was published next week, I wouldn't read it. Like, if there was something of that, like, level, and also, you know, with hindsight, usefulness to the world, I'd probably still have room for that in my life, but it's more the, like, the lower nutritional value crime stuff that I've removed from my diet, if
and
you will.
And also, yeah, I think it's the difference as well between reading something like I'll Be Gone in the Dark, which is a seminal piece of true crime writing, obviously, and compared that to something like listening to a podcast talking about the Golden State Killer, a crime I already know about because I've already read a book. I think that I had more patience for hearing the same story from different perspectives previously. But actually, those different perspectives were all still mostly white American perspectives. Mm. I think that's also something that, like, I think I'm just like, I've heard enough about Richard Ramirez now. I've heard enough about Dennis Nielsen. Like, I don't need to think about these men anymore. And I find it unlikely that, never say never, but I find it unlikely that anyone is going to come out the woodwork with the definitive, like, Jeffrey Dahmer book, and I'm going to be like, fuck, I need to read
this
that.
This is my time.
I know the story. I don't need it. I didn't know the Golden State Killer story when I read the Michelle McNamara book. And the book itself, the writing was incredible.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that's another difference as well. I may be less interested in dwelling within the same crimes.
In the murky pond. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Legit. Very interesting. So do you feel like Death of a Bookseller shares DNA with stuff you've already written? I guess the answer is yes, because it cannibalizes things you've already written.
Oh, well, it only cannibalized one short story, which became Laura's section. Or became one element of Laura's section. I don't know about that. I'd need someone else to tell me. I think I probably will always return to certain themes. I write a lot about grief. I write a lot about obsession and like kind of toxicity. I do really love parasocial relationships, and I quite enjoy, I think my next book, one of the main things that my next book will have in common with Death of a Bookseller is taking a contemporary interest and that I have mixed feelings about, and exploring it through different characters and their relationship to that interest. But I don't want to end... That's not going to end up being my whole career. It's just the second book I already had this idea.
You're the contemporary interest guy.
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
Fuck me. Here's fucking Slater with another contemporary interest novel. Fuck it out.
What's the issue of the day? Do you feel like there are particular authors that, like, influenced this book? We got a little sprinkle of Erin Kelly in there. A little poison tree.
There's a little poison tree.
In all of us.
I think the book that influenced me the most was actually a book that I read specifically as research for the novel. But it's called Savage Appetites by Rachel Monroe.
I got it in there because of the Columbine stuff. That yes, exactly. Made me think about Savage Appetites.
But that also was really helpful because I had started to worry a little bit about, like, the more time I spent researching true crime fanatics, and I mean, like, the kinds of people who get, like, mad tattoos and shit, the more I realised that you cannot actually be a true crime, like, that deep into that world without essentially subscribing to other political values, which I did not want to put into this character. I actually didn't want Roach to be a right-wing.
Fash.
I didn't want her to be fascist. I didn't want her to be interested in any of that shit. Her vibe is a more creepy, gothy murder vibe, not like a race hate vibe.
Yeah.
So actually reading Savage Appetites and reading that section on Columbine, when I realized more about what those quote-unquote fandoms were actually like, I realized that was actually a good opportunity for the character to also have that realization that maybe this thing that she was really into
was skirting very close.
It's too close to something that she's smart enough to know is not what she wants to be associated with. Which, you know, again, I think it gives the character a little bit of depth. Like, she does, at that point in her life, have a boundary. Obviously, later on, her boundaries disintegrate in other ways, but... So, yeah, Savage Appetites. And also, Savage Appetites still does not have a publisher in the UK.
It's so wild, because that is such a good book, and it's such an interesting book, and such a, like... You know, there is such an appetite for true crime. And I think even if you do consume true crime, which at the time we both read it, I think we both were still on that in some way.
Yeah, definitely.
It's just interesting. It's just really interesting.
It's just a great book.
And it's got stories from places that you don't normally hear, you know, like the Lindsay Suvannavejh Columbine obsessive thing. I feel like that was the first time I'd encountered that story, which is like an interesting compliment to, you know... So we've got Savage Appetites. Anything else you'd like to name check?
Yeah, so Laura's sections. I spent a lot of time thinking about the kind of millennial ennui in the workplace genre. Mm. So books like The New Me by Hallie Butler. To a certain extent, My Year of Rest and Relaxation by Tessa Moshfegh. Sweet Bitter by Stephanie Danler. Convenience Store Woman by Sayaka Murata. A little bit of that went into Roach, and a little bit of that, I think, is present in Laura as well. So, yeah, like, I was thinking a lot about... I think Sweet Bitter really was, like, the archetype of what I was aiming for with the Laura sections when things were good. You know, like, a book that
camaraderie.
Just, yeah, and, like, showing the kind of... lifting the bonnet on an industry, like, showing what it was like in that kind of... in that retail space. Yeah, the end.
No, those are two very interesting little routes for your influences to go down. I appreciate it, my friend. You've spent so much of your life writing. Does it feel different now to write with the, like, confidence that being published has given you? Or not really?
There's definitely a difference in knowing that whatever you write is going to be read. That's a different kind of responsibility. You don't kind of have the same sort of, like, carefree vibe of, like, experimenting and writing anything gross or weird or fun or personal or confessional or whatever. Like, everything is going to be read by someone else. So that definitely probably makes me feel a little bit more cautious about what I want to put into my work, which isn't a bad thing anyway, because everything that you write may end up being read by someone else. Aside from that, though, I mean, I think... Death of a Bookseller just consumed me for so long. And then my second book, I actually only handed it in a week ago. And that was hell to write.
Obviously, I would like to talk about book two as much as you would like to talk about book two.
Yeah.
So, shall we talk about book two?
We can do a little bit about book two.
That's kind of like what you have been writing since you wrote Death of Booksellers.
Yeah.
So, maybe the question is specifically about the writing of book two.
Well, so basically, book two, I had given a very rough verbal pitch during the selling of book one. So, my editor at Hodder, I had kind of told her what the vague vibe was going to be, and she was really into it. So I felt immediately quite stitched to that. And I probably could have changed the idea, but I really kind of flirted with whether or not what kind of book I wanted to do with this idea. And I think that's where it got really difficult. As you may know, at one point I was going to set it in the south of France. And then I was like, no, actually it's not right. It doesn't feel right. It doesn't feel like something that would follow Death of a Bookseller. So then I've transplanted it to New Orleans, which I'm so much happier with. It's my favorite city in the world. I've been half a dozen times. And I feel much more confident with it now. I'm really having fun with it. And that's the thing. I think if it's not fun for me to write, it's not going to be fun to read. I just think you can read the, like, work it between the words. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I don't want to talk about the plot because anything could change.
Yeah.
But it's fun. That's all I'm going to say. It's in New Orleans and I'm having a nice time.
Good. It was a bit, you know, a struggle to get there, but you've got there.
It's just the first draft, isn't it? Like, first draft. Lots of people kind of said, like, oh, it's the old book two thing. I think to a degree it's the pressure of knowing that this book is going to be, like, that it has certain expectations on it. But actually, that wasn't even the struggle. The struggle was just, what do I want my second book to be? Like, what do I actually want to say? I always remember this thing that you said about No Big Deal, but it was like, if I only wrote one book, what do I actually want to say with it? And that's what I come back to a lot. I'm like, if I only write one book set in New Orleans, only one book on this particular topic, what do I actually want to say? What do I want to say? Not what do I think I should say about this.
Yeah,
like, what am I actually doing? I don't know. I think I'm getting there. See what my editor says. Maybe by the time this airs, it's all gone to shit.
We'll go back and edit this out and pretend it never happened.
We'll just re-record it and I'll say there is no book two.
I have returned my advance.
Yeah, I've Caroline Calloway'd it.
Speaking of great influences like Caroline Calloway, is there like a underrated banger you've read recently that you want to shout out?
Oh my god, underrated is a toughie.
I just feel like, you know, we're swimming in a soup where everyone talks about the same shit. You, Alice Slater, can do better.
So I'm in my slowest reading year to date. I'm probably only reading less than one book a week. I just spent 2 weeks reading something which I didn't even like that much.
We can talk about that later.
So yeah, I'll talk to you on the train to Oxford about that one. But actually, this book that I have read that I do want to flag, we did an episode already though. We've talked about them. I was gonna say The Sluts, but we talked about it.
By Dennis.
I literally haven't read anything else. Dennis Cooper. I haven't read a fucking word of anything other than this one thing I didn't enjoy since we recorded that episode.
Okay, well, The Sluts by Dennis Cooper. I mean, that's like a very edgy little tome.
Read that, but you will struggle. Regardless, I'm like, as I'm saying this, by the way, I'm looking into the phone as though I'm speaking to an audience. Like, regardless of how thick you think your skin is or how strong your stomach, you will struggle. And in fact, Emily Hatzar, our good friend of the pod and stained glass artist.
Who we're seeing imminently.
Who we're seeing soon, and we cannot wait. She's reading at the minute, and she was like, I had to put it down. I was like, oh, I know which point. And she shared what made her put the book down. I was like,
not even
oh
close,
my god,
mate.
That's not even... That's like nothing.
So originally this was going to be my last question, but you're too interesting. I want to keep chatting.
Yeah.
Regarding what you just said about The Sluts, was there anything that you wanted to put in or that you wrote and then deleted that you were like, I've taken it too far?
Oh, that is such a good question.
Because it is very dark. It goes very dark places.
Here's the mad thing though. I find that some people describe it as very dark. It got rejected by one publisher. For being too cozy.
This is mad.
And I'm not seeking out reviews. I'm not interested in reading reviews. Like, I don't think that that's good for authors. But I know that one criticism that the book has received is that it's not dark enough.
Mm.
Whereas other reviews are just like, fuck me.
You know what? I bet the people saying that it's not dark enough are little true crime freaks.
I bet they are.
Love
it. Or they read a lot of Dennis Cooper.
Yeah.
But like, that's, I mean, because even though I know it, the book does go to some dark places, my personal opinion is I don't think it's that dark. I think it's that dark. Do you know what I mean?
It's not dark in terms of, like, I don't know how to explain it, but, like, there's stuff that happens. So, one of my favourite podcasts of all time is called Criminal. And it's, like, not true crime in the traditional way. It's more interesting stories about crimes. And one of the best episodes of Criminal, which is one of the best episodes of anything I've ever read, is called A Bump in the Night or something like that. And it's basically about, like, people being somewhere they're not meant to be.
Ooh, sounds so good.
Discovering someone in your home who's not meant to be there.
For example.
And to me, that's, like, one of the most, like, disturbing things I can think of. And so I don't think anyone needs to get, like, you know, stabbed in the eyeball for it to be dark. You know, I just think it operates on such a good dark psychological level. So I think the darkness is definitely there, and it's definitely enough.
Yeah, I guess it's such a subjective thing, right? Like, I feel like
it's like bloody we had to remove this post all over again.
Yeah, exactly. Which I considered. I didn't find it that dark. I warned people, though, that it does touch upon pretty much everything that you could possibly need a content warning for.
Which this doesn't.
No, definitely not.
But
that still received so many people were so mad that it wasn't as dark. And then someone else cried about it on TikTok, and I felt really bad. Anyway.
So my question was more, sorry, is there
I looked at Bethany then like a broken doll. Just like...
Blink. Is there stuff that you took out have put in that you're like, oh, I kind of wish I hadn't done that? Or
no, if anything, I added in more dark bits. I think I really like amped up the darkness of Sam, Rach's boyfriend. I made him scarier. He was a bit softer and a bit nicer in the first draft, but I felt like he needed to feel more threatening, more ominous. I don't think I recall taking anything out because I felt it was too dark.
Yeah.
Most of the stuff that came out was because it was too boring.
As it should be. That's what's gotta go.
I remember my editor flagged one bit about Christmas stock and she was like,
you've taken it too far.
It's fair enough, you know.
Well, it's like when you do research for a book and you want to put it all in, you're like, I want to put everything I know about bookselling in this book about bookselling. What if I never write another book about bookselling?
Can I just say, I had the honor of going to the warehouse the other day, and I had the time of my life asking the most inane questions about warehouse ops you can imagine.
Isn't it so interesting, all of that stuff?
I love it.
Okay, well, I feel like I've asked you everything that I wanted to ask you. Is there anything you want me to ask you?
Yes, I would like you to ask me if I'm doing any events.
Alice. We're going to Oxford tonight, which by the time this episode comes out will be in the past, unfortunately. So anyone that's listening cannot come. But there are places they can go.
There are. So
they can't go to Oxford. They can't go to Gower Street. That will be in the past.
They're all in the past tense. But in the future, on Tuesday the 2nd of May, I'm going to be in Edinburgh at the Portobello Bookshop.
Delightful.
That's going to be a good time with Kirsty Logan. Then on Wednesday the 3rd of May, I'm going to be in Manchester, being interviewed by a bookseller there called Martha, who's an absolute dreamboat. And that's at Waterstones Deansgate. Then on Thursday, although as I say this, I think this event might be sold out, I'm going to be in West Kirby.
Yay!
With our boy Jordan Taylor Jones.
Top lad, JTJ.
So that's at the West Kirby Bookshop. And then the following week, you can catch me in Brighton on May the 10th.
Which is when I'll be in bookshop. Manchester, because I'm devastated.
I know, we were going to have a reprieve.
I'm going to be
reprieve.
Way
to ruin the flow. Me?
Reprieve.
Whatever. We were going to do a redo.
We're going to do an Oxford do-over.
Yeah. But instead, I'm going to be with Imogen West Knights, which is going to be super fun.
Well, I'm going to be
what are you going to be doing?
Manchester Deansgate, where you were the week before. Two other lady romance authors called Cheska Majors and Paige Toon.
Gorge.
I will be there while you are there. You'll so, you know, if you're in the north, come to Manchester. If you're in the south, go to Brighton. If you want one of us
and then
on the 10th.
Finally, on the 11th of May, I'm going to be back in London at Phlox Books, which is my old local. And we're going to do like a cocktail quiz night evening.
Delightful.
So I'm going to be everywhere. Otherwise, if you can't come to any of them, Portobello Bookshop is also going to be live streaming and you can buy a ticket for like £3.
I love it.
I love it too.
Well,
let's hit the road. Let's hit the bricks.
Let's go to bloody Oxford.
It's Oxford.
I will see you next time.
Bye. Oh, wait. We have one more thing to say.
What is it?
Also, yesterday, on the auspicious day of my book launch, the paperback of Welcome to Your Life by Bethany Rutter is available.
Also came out.
Yeah, and I presume if you're listening to this podcast, you have already read the hardback. But if you have not, you can now purchase the more portable, the smaller.
The floppier.
The fleet.
What?
I was going to say sleeker.
Fleeper.
The fleeper. Paperback.
Paperback on fleek. See you next time.
That's it. Bye.